You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is April the 12th, 102nd day of the year. 263 days remain to the year's over with. Let's see, holidays and observances. Day of silence. Give your vocal cords a break. International Day of Human Spaceflight. National for 12's Day. National Only Child Day. World Hamster Day. National Grilled Cheese Sandwich Day. National Big Wind Day, and we got that today. Yuri's Night. National Licorice Day. Deckfast Day. Walk on Your Wild Side Day. Discover National Parks Fortnight. Be Active, Be Healthy, Be Happy Week. Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival. It starts today and goes through Sunday, April 21st. Parkinson's Awareness Week. Edinburgh Science Festival. National Library Week. The Masters. Starts yesterday and goes through the 14th. FOP Awareness Month. Famous people born on this date. Tulsi Gabbard. Saoirse Ronan. Claire Danes. Jennifer Morrison. And April is also International Guitar Month. Step Up for 30 for Bowel Cancer Month. Scottish American Heritage Month. Global Volunteer Month. National Alcohol Awareness Month. National Soy Foods Month. National Food Month, National Month of Hope, National Soft Pretzel Month, Animal Cruelty Prevention Month, National Volunteer Month, Sexual Assault Awareness Month, National Kite Month, National Garden Month, National Poetry Month, Autism Acceptance Month, National Pickleball Month, Limb Loss and Limb Difference Awareness Month, Stress Awareness Month, National Jazz Appreciation Month, Poetic Earth Month, National Couple Appreciation Month, Adoptive Ferret Month, Straw Hat Month, Month of the Military Child, Active Dog Month, Summer Tire Changeover Month, National Decorating Month, Parkinson's Awareness Month. Alrighty, and our little history segment. In 240 AD, Shapur I becomes co-emperor of the Sasanian Empire with his father, Ardashir, 467, Antemius is elevated to emperor of the Western Roman Empire. Remember, at one point, the Roman Empire was so large and so unwieldy, it divided into two empires, the Eastern, which became the Byzantine Empire, and the Western, which eventually collapsed. 627, King Edward of Northumbria is converted to Christianity by Paulinus, Bishop of York. In the year 1012, Duke Aldrich of Bohemia deposes and blinds his brother, Jaromir, who flees to Poland. Yeah. 1204, the Crusaders of the Fourth Crusade breach the walls of Constantinople and enter the city, which they completely occupy the next day. 1606, the Union flag is adopted as a flag of English and Scottish ships. 1776, American Revolution. With the Halifax Resolves, the North Carolina Provincial Congress authorizes its congressional delegation to vote for independence from Britain. The Halifax Resolves, for those that are not familiar, was a name given to the resolution adopted by the North Carolina Provincial Congress. The adoption of this resolution was the first official action in the American colonies calling for independence from Great Britain during the American Revolution. It helped pave the way for the presentation to Congress of the Declaration of Independence less than 3 months later. So it all began in North Carolina. 1807, the Froberg Mutiny on Malta ends with the remaining mutineers blow up the magazines of Fort Ricasoli. The Froberg Mutiny, for those who are not familiar, that was a mutiny within the British Armed Forces staged between the 4th and 12th of April, 1807. Malta was a British protectorate, and it was the Froberg Regiment that mutinied. Been formed using dubious methods with personnel recruited from various nationalities in Albania and the Ottoman Empire. The troops who arrived in Malta in 1806 were unhappy with their rank and pay. The mutiny actually lasted for 8 days, during which several people were killed and the fort was damaged. It was put down and the ringleaders were executed. It was considered the most serious mutiny of the Napoleonic Wars. And it was the Froberg Regiment. 1820. Alexander Lipsiantis is declared leader of Feliki Eteria, a secret organization to overthrow Ottoman rule over Greece. 1831, soldiers marching on the Broughton Suspension Bridge in Manchester, England, caused it to collapse. The marching in their normal lockstep, the vibrations was too much for the bridge. 1861, American Civil War, Battle of Fort Sumter. War begins with Confederate forces firing on Fort Sumter, located in the harbor of Charleston, South Carolina. I've been there. I had a period at the Citadel Military College of South Carolina. Let me say, it was not one of my favorite times. 1862, American Civil War. The Andrews Raids, which gave rise to the great locomotive chase, occurs on this date. Starts in Big Shanty, Georgia, now Kennesaw. Union Raiders hijacked the train, and it was supposed to run north to the Union lines, destroying bridges and railroad tracks on the way. Didn't quite work out as they anticipated. 1864, the Battle of Fort Pillow. Confederate forces killed most of the African-American soldiers that surrendered at Fort Pillow, Tennessee. 1865, American Civil War. Mobile, Alabama falls to the Union Army. 1877, United Kingdom annexes the Transvaal. 1900, one day after its enactment by Congress, President McKinley signs the Foraker Act into law, which gives Puerto Rico limited self-rule. 1910, the SMS Zerini, one of the last pre-dreadnought battleships built by the Austro-Hungarian Navy, is launched. Nothing like being obsolete at the time you're launched. 1917, World War I, Canadian forces successfully complete the taking of Vimy Ridge from the Germans. 1927, Shanghai Massacre, 1927. Shanghai Shek orders the Chinese Communist Party members executed in Shanghai, ending the First United Front. 1927, Rock Springs, Texas, is hit by an F-5 tornado. Destroys 235 of the 247 buildings in the town. Kills 72 townspeople and injures 205. Third deadliest tornado in Texas history. 1928, the Bremen, German Junkers, W-33 type aircraft, takes off with the first successful transatlantic airplane flight from east to west. 1934, the strongest surface wind gust in the world at the time of 231 miles per hour is measured on the summit of Mount Washington, New Hampshire. It has since been surpassed. 1934, U.S. auto light strike begins, culminating in a 5-day melee between the Ohio National Guard and the 6,000 strikers and picketers. 1937, that was a Donnybrook to watch, let me tell you. 1937, Sir Frank Whittle ground tests the first jet engine designed to power an aircraft at Rugby, England. 1945, President Roosevelt dies in office on this date. Vice President Harry Truman becomes president upon Roosevelt's death. Also in 1945, World War II, the U.S. Ninth Army under General William Simpson crosses the Elbe River astride Magdeburg and reaches Tangamunde. That's only 50 miles from Berlin. 1955, the polio vaccine developed by Dr. Jonas Salk is declared safe and effective on this date. 1961, space race. Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin becomes the first human to travel into outer space, perform the first crewed orbital flight in Vostok 1. 1963, the Soviet nuclear-powered submarine K-33 collides with the Finnish merchant vessel MS Finn Clipper in the Danish Straits. 1970, Soviet submarine K-8, carrying four nuclear torpedoes, sinks in the Bay of Biscay. That was 4 days after a fire broke out on board. 1980, the American-Liberian governor of Liberia is violently deposed. 1980, Trans-Brazil Flight 303, a Boeing 727, crashes on approach to Hercules-Oluz International Airport in Florianopolis, Brazil. 55 people out of the 58 on board are killed. 1980, Canadian runner and athlete Terry Fox begins his Marathon of Hope run in St. John's, Newfoundland. 1981, the first launch of a space shuttle, the Columbia, takes place on this date. STS-1 is the mission. 1983, Harold Washington is elected the first black mayor of Chicago. 1985, Space Shuttle Discovery launches on STS-51D to deploy two communication satellites. 1990, Jim Gary's 20th Century Dinosaurs exhibition opens at Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of Natural History in Washington. He's the only sculptor ever invited to present a solo exhibition there. Must have known somebody. 1990, Wunderow Flight 839 crashes after takeoff from Værøy Airport, Norway, killed five people. 1992, the Euro Disney Resort officially opens with its theme park, Euro Disneyland. The resort and the park's name are subsequently changed to Disneyland Paris. 1999, U.S. President Bill Clinton is cited for contempt of court for giving intentionally false statements in a civil lawsuit. He's later fined and disbarred. 1999, during the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia, an American McDonnell Douglas F-15E Strike Eagle shoots a passenger train, killing between 20 and 60 people. Now that, oops, I didn't mean to shoot at the train. 2002, a suicide bomber blows herself up at the entrance to Jerusalem's Mohini Lahuda Market, kills seven people and wounded 104. 2007, a suicide bomber penetrates the green zone and detonates in a cafeteria within a parliament building, killed Iraqi member of parliament Mohammed Awad and wounded more than 20 other people. 2009, Zimbabwe officially abandons the Zimbabwean dollar as its official currency. 2010, Murano derailment. Train accident in South Tyrol kills nine and injures another 28. 2013, two suicide bombers killed three Chadian soldiers and injured dozens of civilians at a market in Kidal in Mali. And in 2014, the Great Fire Valparaiso ravages the Chilean city of Valparaiso, killed 16 people, displacing nearly 10,000, destroyed over 2,000 homes. You know, it's interesting to note so many of the suicide bombers do it in the name of their religion. And you've got to wonder what type of religion teaches. Blow yourself up along with anybody you can get to. Now, a couple of things that have come up that I think are interesting. Donald Trump went into a Chick-fil-A. All the meals are on him. The judge in Arizona walked out of the courtroom in the middle of proceedings, exasperated with both sides of the trial. The judge is named Thomas Fink of Santa Cruz County Superior Court in Arizona. He's presiding over the trial of rancher George Kelly. He's accused of murder after the fatal shooting of Mexican national Gabriel Cuen Butiemia. Fink got up and left the bench while the defense was presenting, deferring to the clerk and court reporter. He has accused both the defense and the prosecution of unnecessarily dragging out the oral arguments. Jurors have heard testimony regarding where and what distance Kelly was standing when prosecutors argue he fatally shot the deceased. The defense maintained that Kelly only fired warning shots into the air from his patio earlier that day, and his wife testified about dialing their Border Patrol ranch liaison when they spotted two armed men dressed in camouflage and carrying rifles and backpacks walking about 100 feet from their home. See, this is part of the problem with this administration and our southern border. The door is open. Because the number of people in an area at the time of the census determines the congressional representative numbers as well as Electoral College numbers. And Kelly's defense has tried to sow doubt on the forensic evidence and the autopsy report. There's a question about whether or not it was Kelly's gun that actually killed the man. The bullet was never recovered. And a consultant for Kelly's defense said none of the state's witnesses so far provided any rebuttal testimony against the defense theory that a gang of bandits, sometimes cartel-affiliated, shot the deceased and robbed him. The rancher has already rejected a deal from prosecutors that would have reduced the charge to one count of negligent homicide if he'd plead guilty. The problem is that in the minds of most prosecutors, accusation equals guilt. Americans are automatically wrong. Undocumented immigrants are automatically right. And it's getting worse. Well, we've been talking about haunted locations. Yesterday we talked about Red Fox, who still haunts his home. Right now we're talking about the the Oasis Motel. And the ghost of David Strickland. Now, he showed up. And the Oasis, if you've never been to Vegas, is in a, shall we say, less than stellar part of town. And he was last seen crossing the street to the convenience store. When next time anybody saw him, he was hanging from a beam in the room. Now, David Gordon Strickland was born October 14, 1969. From Glen Cove, Long Island. But he moved to Princeton, New Jersey, with his family when he was very young. And while he was still in high school, he moved to California in Pacific Palisades, a suburb of Los Angeles. And by all accounts, he had no intention of getting into acting before he moved to California. But like so many folks before him, the lure of Hollywood took hold, and he joined a theater company instead of going to college. And it was while he was with that theater company that he got the calling. He started by performing comedy sketches and worked his way into parts of Biloxi Blues and Bye Bye Birdie and Danny in the Deep Blue Sea and The Pizza Man and I Won't Dance. He also worked on a number of student films and found he had a bit of talent in front of the camera. 1998, he's able to lend a guest starring role on Roseanne, another on Dave's World in 1993. 1992, he landed a recurring 5-episode role on the sitcom Mad About You. He played Hollis, a co-worker of Paul Reiser's character, Paul Buckman on the Explorer Channel. Hollis turns out to be a villain on the show, stabbed Paul Buckman in the back. 1994, Strickland ended another 3-episode guest starring role as Dace on Sister Sister, a sitcom that starred Tia and Tamara Mowry. But Strickland's probably best known for the role he had at the time of his death He played Todd Stites, music critic for the San Francisco based magazine, The Gate, on Suddenly Susan. He played a quirky, lovable character who suffered from a short attention span, attributed to the addiction to MTV. And the show premiered September 1st, 1996, and was going into his fourth year when his body was found. His character had been slated to develop a romance with the show's star, Brooke Shields. Well, the weekend that he hung himself from the beam with a king-size sheet, a movie to which he had a role, opened at the number one spot, Forces of Nature. Stars Sandra Bullock and Ben Affleck. The film grossed $13.9 million its opening weekend. Strickland played a small role of Steve Montgomery, the hometown suitor of Affleck's fiancée. Now, while the role may have been small, his star was getting larger. But it turns out, according to all reports, he had a dark side. On the day his body was found, he was due to appear in the Los Angeles court to report on his progress in a drug diversion program he'd been ordered to get into. He was arrested October 31st, 1998, and charged with possession of cocaine. Well, he pled no contest in December of that year and ordered into the program. Got a 36-month probation. Had he successfully completed the program, the charge would have been stricken from his record. But drugs weren't his only issue. He'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, a condition that caused severe mood swings that ranged from depression to the heights of an excessive excitement or enthusiasm. When people are on a low swing, they feel sad or hopeless. They lose interest in things previously been important to them. Now, in most cases, bipolar can be controlled with medication and psychological counseling. And although reports indicated he was taking the mood stabilizer lithium, it's not known whether or not he was receiving therapy as well. Unfortunately, when a person's on a high, he or she may stop taking the medication, feeling it's unnecessary, and he was one of those people. A few weeks before his death, he was cheerful and eager to discuss his future in an interview he gave. Well, he arrived in Vegas Saturday, March 20th, 1999. What he did from the time he arrived till he was found dead Monday morning is a mystery. Some reports indicate he was seen at the downtown strip club Glitter Gulch with fellow actor Andy Dick. Dick would later confirm he'd been with Strickland, and while he didn't know the young man well, he said he was fun and was a great guy. Well, checkout time at the Oasis is around 10 a.m. People tended not to stay in the rooms very long. And when Sherry Alvarez, who was the clerk, didn't see any sign of the young man, her husband checked in the night before, she decided to call the phone in the room. And it rang with no answer on the other end. She told her husband he has to be a heavy sleeper, and he decided to go to the room to check on him. Taking a spare key, she walked over to room 20, stood on the reddish fall stones painted onto the concrete outside the door, knocked loud enough to wake the young man up if he was still sleeping. Well, when she didn't get an answer, she knocked again. This time, she didn't wait for a response. Opened the door, and she saw a figure fully clothed standing in the room. Chair seemed to be knocked over behind him. And she was about to apologize for opening the door when she saw the sheet around his neck. When she realized what she was looking at, she started screaming. Anybody who was asleep at that point would have been awake. Now Juan, hearing the screaming, ran to the room and found the same sight that his wife had found. The young man Juan had checked in under the name of David Strickland was hanging from a beam in the center of the room, a sheet tied tightly around his neck. Juan got over his initial shock. He realized Strickland was fully clothed and his feet were touching the floor. Well, Juan said he's alive and ran past his wife and ran up to the man hanging from the sheet and started to pull it from around his neck. The sheet was tight, much too tight, as Juan tried to release it, his hand touched the young man's neck. At that point, he knew the truth. Strickland was dead. He told his wife to call the police, and she bolted out of the room. And while he was waiting for the police to arrive, he looked around the room and saw some empty beer bottles and didn't see any drugs, didn't find any suicide note. And the bottles, six of them, were aligned perpendicular to the bed, all in line with the base of a table sitting beside the bed. Well, as he went into the bathroom, he saw a sight that, well, it was upsetting. The light fixture was part of the ceiling fan had been ripped out. Electric wires were hanging down, and the fixture still hanging from them. And at that point, Strickland knew that using the beam had been Strickland's first attempt to take his life that evening. 4 days later, the Alva residents packed up their belongings and gave their notice to the Oasis Motel. They left town with their 4-year-old son. Last words to the owners was, "We came here for a better life, but this is not a good environment." Well, Strickland wasn't the only famous person to die at the Oasis Motel. The November 22nd, 1998, just 4 months before Strickland hung himself, 3-time world champion poker player Stu the Kid Ungar was found dead in room 6 of the motel. He was well known for the round lemon-like sunglasses he wore, linen-like sunglasses he wore while playing poker. He checked into room 6, November 20th, paid $58 a night. While he had won an estimated $30 million during his poker career, he also had a severe drug and gambling habit. 1990, he'd been found on the floor of his hotel room suffering from a drug overdose. Well, while he'd eventually recover from this overdose, his abuse of drugs would take a serious toll on his body from which he wouldn't be able to recover. In 1998 interview with Icon Magazine, he said, "I did coke to keep up, use it as an excuse to stay up and play poker. But unfortunately, then you take it home with you." Well, months after he gave this interview, he was found lying on the bed in room 6, had $800 in his pocket. Just signed a contract with casino mogul Bob Stupak to assume all his debts and to front his gambling. So why would Stu Ungar, a world-class poker player, stay in a rundown motel in the middle of one of the worst areas of Las Vegas? And why would David Strickland, a young star with seemingly bright future, take his own life? Well, coroner Ron Flood said in 1999, "We have 300 suicides a year, and you can ask that same question about all of them." Well, according to some reports, Jasmine whispered something prophetic to Strickland before they parted ways. She supposedly said the important changes are happening in your life. Coroner's able to place his death at about 4 in the morning. One employee at the Oasis Motel believes that room 20 is haunted. And whether it's Strickland or somebody else, he's not sure. But he says every evening, if you listen closely, you can hear a man crying from that room. Starts his cry at about 1 in the morning and stops at 4. And then the voice says 2 words. "Help me." So you have to ask yourself, is that David Strickland calling for help? Well, sometimes success isn't the panacea that you think it is. Let's look at Bobby Hatfield, successful member of the singing duo, the Righteous Brothers. And while he had a series of success in his lifetime, he also had a dark secret. One that would eventually cost him his life. But he did achieve all his dreams, including the first one he ever had, to be a good enough singer to play in Las Vegas. Well, Vegas had been Bobby Hatfield's favorite town to perform in, and seemed fitting to do a tribute concert there. Bill Medley was apprehensive about going on stage without his longtime partner, Bobby. Wondered if the crowd would Appreciate his solo effort if he'd be able to get through the first song. As he stood behind the curtain waiting to go on stage, his mind went back to that day in 2003 when he was first told about Bobby's death. Show was scheduled to start in 50 minutes, and his partner was nowhere to be found. Well, Medley was, of course, annoyed and pacing back and forth, mumbling to himself. "This is typical," he remarked. He had just started their reunion tour, and there he was standing in the Miller Auditorium in Kalamazoo, Michigan, on the campus of the Western Michigan University. Half of the famous Righteous Brothers. Folks didn't pay to see half. They paid to see the Righteous Brothers. So he asked the stage manager, "Anybody tried to call him?" And the Righteous Brothers manager interjected at that point and said, "I've tried." Medley said, "Is he even in the building?" And the manager said, "I don't think so." "Well, maybe somebody ought to go to his hotel room and find out where he is." Well, he was angry. He was fit to be tied. Well, when the Righteous Brothers that had broken up got back together, Medley wasn't sure that Hatfield had beaten his cocaine addiction. In fact, he had a sneaking suspicion Hatfield was still using. This was probably the reason he wasn't there yet. And in addition to being angry, he was worried about Hatfield's well-being. Well, he paced even more as the auditorium filled with 2,400 anxious fans ready to hear the songs he'd grown up with. "It's like you've lost that loving feeling and unchained melody." And he remembered he nervously primped in front of the mirror, ready to read Bobby the Riot Act as soon as the concert ended. Well, it was about 20 minutes later when David Cohen, the manager of the Righteous Brothers, came back and had a terrible look on his face. Couldn't even look Medley in the face. So Medley finally said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "It's Hatfield. Don't tell me he's no shape to perform." "Well, he's dead, Bill." Well, that news hit Medley like a kick to the gut. "What do you mean he's dead?" "Just that, he's dead. Bobby Hatfield is dead." And now, years later, here he was again, half of the famous Righteous Brothers, about to go on stage and sing a tribute to his dead partner. He took a deep breath as he was announced and smiled, said a quick prayer, and walked on stage. When he started that first song, the crowd cheered loudly and Medley began to relax. And as he sang the songs that made the two of them famous, it was hard to believe his longtime friend and partner was dead. In fact, it felt like Bobby Hatfield was standing there in his usual spot right beside him. And when the show ended, the crowd gave him a standing ovation. Now, he called the band at the front of the stage for them to take their bows. As they waved, acknowledging the cheers from the crowd, they heard a loud pop from over their heads. Well, fearing for their safety, the band members jumped backwards as shards of glass fell on the stage. They all looked up and saw it was one of the park hands that exploded through the jail. And it was the park hand that would have been over the head of Bobby Hatfield if he had been in his usual position on stage. Some kind of sign, perhaps. Well, Bobby Hatfield, real name Robert Lee Hatfield, born August 19, 1940, in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. 4 years old, he moved with his family to Anaheim, California. And having spent some time in Anaheim, let me tell you, that place is a hoot. Entertainment bug hit him when he was only a third grader as he sang Short and Bread on a local radio show. And he was also a gifted athlete and popular in school. Student body president, played on his high school's baseball team. He was scouted by the L.A. Dodgers. He was so good. Also sang in his high school chorus. 1 year, he was asked to be the manager of master of ceremonies for his high school's talent show until a last-minute decision changed his life. 2 days prior to the show, for some unknown reason, I decided to sing. And I was never so scared in my life, and also never so thankful that I had dark pants on. He said, I sang Johnny Mathis's Chances Aren't, even though I thought the sound of my knees banging together was drowning out my voice. I pulled it off. 1959, he graduated from high school and decided not to sign with the Dodgers. Instead, he was determined to pursue a career in entertainment. Met Bill Medley in 62, and the two were brought together by Johnny Wimber as part of the five-piece band known as the Paramours. Wimber was the keyboard player. Legend has it the band was playing one night in a local bar when a black Marine shouted out, "That was Righteous Brothers," after one of their duets. So from that unexpected response to their singing, they took the name and the Righteous Brothers were born. Hatfield Medley didn't have dreams of topping the charts, even being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They just wanted to be good enough to play in Vegas. According to Medley, when we started out, rock and roll was thought to be only a fad. Some DJs are even smashing their records into so-called devil music, so we were always talking about what we'd do next. Well, as the Paramours, they released a single called There She Goes on the Moonglow label in December of 62. Within 3 months, the Paramours disbanded, leaving Hatfield Medley to carry on as the Righteous Brothers. And it's, truth be known, they were a perfect match. Medley's rich bass and Hatfield's gospel-inflected tenor created a harmonious blend that was truly unique. Its depth of soul often made people think they were listening to two African-Americans. It also helped there were two of the few white people in California who were into rhythm and blues. Hatfield once said, we weren't out there playing surf music. So they recorded their first album, had a minor hit with Little Latin Loopy Lou. Well, it may have been a minor hit. It caught the attention of record producer Phil Spector. Righteous Brothers recorded two more albums before Spector bought out their contract and signed into his Phillies label. And it was with Spector their fame would be solidified. Well, the year 1964 was a good one for the harmonic duo. Not only did they open for such acts as the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, they're also regulars on ABC TV Shindig. That same year, the Paris Vegas Dreams came true. They're performing three shows a night in the lounge of the famous Sands Hotel. That's where the Rat Pack became famous. They're also spending a lot of time in the recording studio. During one of these recording sessions, they produced one of their most famous singles, You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling, written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, specifically for the Righteous Brothers. Well, Medley said later, we had no idea it'd be a hit. It's too slow, too long, and right in the middle of the Beatles and the British invasion. But not only would that song become a hit, it also have the most important quality a song can have. It has staying power. That song entered the top 40 the day after Christmas that same year, hit number one 2 months later. Songs at that point in time were typically short, no more than 2 or 3 minutes at the most. This song was 4 minutes long, sparking Medley's concern about the length. And to prevent radio DJs from refusing to play the song, Spector listed it on the label with a running time of 3 minutes and 5 seconds. The song would eventually be listed as the most played song on the radio. It had more than 8 million recorded plays. Well, as you might guess, the group was on a high. They'd break the Billboard Top 10 four more times in the next 15 months. 1965 became the first act to have three albums in the top 20 at the same time, with Right Now and Some Blue-Eyed Soul on the Moonglow label, and You've Lost That Loving Feeling on the Phillies label. Hearing them sing and realizing they were white, a radio DJ took the phrase Blue-Eyed Soul from their song and used it to describe their sound. Well, Spector tried repeating the process that had created the hit, even employing the soulful songwriter Carole King to write songs for the duo. King, with Jerry Goffin, wrote a song called Hung On You, and Spector allowed the duo to proceed unrestrained on the call-and-answer portion of the song, which was sung mostly together. Now, while Hung On You was masterfully recorded, it didn't catch on with the DJs. Instead, they chose to play the B-side of that record, which came to solo Hatfield had recorded. Unchained Melody became a huge success, reaching number 4 on the top 40 charts. Well, Hatfield and Medley were also the best of friends. Hatfield reportedly had a wonderful sense of humor and took every opportunity available to make his family laugh. 1 year after having his picture taken with Elvis Presley, Hatfield used the photo as his Christmas card, wrote on the card, "From Elvis and the King." By the end of 65, relations with Spector weren't going well, and the pair decided that a clean split with the record producer was in their best interest. Almost immediately signed with the Verve Records, which allowed them to produce their own work. And they released "You're My Soul and Inspiration" by Man and Wheel. Song topped the U.S. charts. Had a string of minor hits before breaking up in 1968. Well, Hatfield had an unsuccessful attempt at a movie career. He was in the films Swingin' Summer and Beach Ball, both of which acted in with Medley. Appeared in the made-for-TV movie The Ballad of Andy Crocker, which, with hopes of it becoming a series, unfortunately it didn't. 1969, Hatfield tried to reform the Righteous Brothers, asking Johnny Walker, the Knickerbockers, to replace Bill Medley. Well, they released only one album before disbanding. 1974, Hatfield Medley reunited, signing with Haven Records. While it was 6 years since the two had performed together, it was like no time had passed. Voices were still in sync, and they produced a number 3 hit with Rock and Roll Heaven. Produced a couple of albums and toured heavily for the next 2 years. Well, they weren't heard from again until they were asked to perform the American Bandstand's 25th anniversary. Success of their performance sparked another tour. Then in 1986, the film Top Gun brought their "You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin'" to a whole new audience. A year later, in 87, Medley sang a duet with Jennifer Warnes called "I've Had the Time of My Life." That was from the film Dirty Dancing, and like the movie, it was an immediate hit. That soundtrack became the most successful since Saturday Night Fever, sold 14 million copies. Well, the day before Hatfield died, Linda, his wife of 32 years, drove him to the airport, kissed him goodbye, and wished him a good trip. He called her later that day and asked her to do him a favor. She said, "Well, that depends on what you want me to do. Could you please take a minute out of your busy schedule and call our dentist and tell him I'm in Kalamazoo, Michigan? I won't be able to make my appointment in an hour." And she laughed and said, "Well, I think I can probably do that." A couple of hours later, he called her and told her to make sure she watched Wheel of Fortune with her mother because he thought it was funny. And those would be the last words he'd ever spoke to her. Next day, she got another phone call. Bill Medley called and said, "It's Bill." She said, "I know your voice." And then he told her the worst news a wife could ever get. Previously called friends so that Linda would have a support unit as she tried to deal with the news. Not willing to have her children find out the news through the media, she frantically called each of them to deliver the devastating news. And she said later it felt like it took forever to get in touch with them. Well, Medley called Linda throughout the night. Nobody in the band would leave Hatfield until they were sure he'd be coming home. Medley told Linda, "We've been together for 42 years. We're not going to leave him here alone." Well, they brought his body home that Friday. When they met Linda, they told her that if Hatfield had any idea he was going to die in Kalamazoo, Michigan, they already come up with 50 jokes about it. Well, he died at the age of 63. He and Medley had been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by Billy Joel just 8 months before. And the reason for his death originally listed as heart failure due to advanced coronary disease. Eventually, it was amended to add acute cocaine intoxication. Medley said, "Bobby and I are like an old married couple. Most of all, I'm going to miss looking to my right and seeing my friend." Well, the services lasted close to 2.5 hours, held at Mariners Church in Irvine with family, friends, and fellow artists in attendance. One close friend said the whole world's a fan of Bobby's music. Hatfield's daughter, Valen, spoke of her palace relation. She said they're perfect for each other. And in true Hatfield style, she brought laughter to the mix and said, "I finally got my dad to come to church with me today." She said, "I thought it'd be my wedding, not his funeral. At least not so soon." In a way, I'm happy he's with God now. I'll be with him someday, and I'll always be your little girl, Daddy. Not everybody gets a chance to sing at his own funeral, but Hatfield did. A 42-year-old video of Hatfield singing Unchained Melody was played. Well, the night the par can fell in front of Bill Medley and his band wasn't the only time Hatfield's presence was felt on stage at the Orleans Hotel Casino. One employee who worked with the Righteous Brothers said, "I'd feel somebody walk by and brush my hair. When I turn around, there'd be nobody there." The Orleans Hotel Casino employees have also reported seeing a man walk down the hallway near the stage in a patterned suit, much like the ones Hatfield was known to wear. They also noted one occasion when nothing in the showroom seemed to be working properly. It was specifically noticed by the lighting person who couldn't get his board to work correctly. Crew knew the cause of the problems when one of them remembered it was Hatfield's birthday. Well, Hatfield has the thought to have taken a clue from the film that made his song Unchained Melody a renewed success in 1990. That movie starred Patrick Swayze. If you remember, he played a ghost in a title role. Before Hatfield's death, he and Medley had discussed making their current tour the last one they'd do. They even had a name for it, The Last Time Around. There's a lot of the casinos in Vegas that have stories of hauntings. There's a lot of stories, more than I could get recorded, of people who had run-ins with various ghosts. And you can look at somebody and tell if he's making it up or if he's saying what happened to him. For example, one of my favorite stories came out of the Hilton, or it used to be the International, where Elvis had his apartment. And if you've ever want to have the feeling of being followed, go tour Elvis's apartment on the top floor of the hotel. You know there's nobody there, but you still have the feeling that there's somebody right there behind you. And there's a number of reminders, or at least there was when I was last there, of Elvis's involvement with the hotel. From the statue out front to the little reminders throughout the hotel. You know, Las Vegas, rightly or wrongly, has the appellation of Sin City attached to it. And a lot of the unexpected deaths happened because of various addictions, if you will. You know, the one reason a lot of folks like to go to Vegas was the saying that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Most who say that aren't thinking about ghosts and unexplained phenomena and other bizarre happenings when they make that comment. And the Strip is a whole lot more than bright lights and gambling and wild shows and quick marriage ceremonies. There are true mysteries in this town. And the Flamingo Hotel has been listed as one of the 10 most haunted sites in America by no less than the Wall Street Journal. It's home to the ghost of Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, often called the man who invented Las Vegas. Even if he was killed in Hollywood, his ghost is said to still live at the Flamingo. I took a tour years ago when I was working on the book, The History and Mystery of Sin City. And we went to the Flamingo. I went to the garden, saw the monument that's in the garden. And several people talked about, shall we say, run-ins they had with the unknown. And then there's another place called the Fox Ridge Apartments. We'll be talking about them in a future show. Those that are out in the dead of night quite often reported to see smoke or mist surrounding the Falk Ridge Park, home of the what's known as the Boy Ghost on a Demon Swing. It's not really known how his ghost ended up in the park, but if you're on the swings, he's been known to push people off. You know, if you spend much time there, I just wander the streets. And I've done that a couple of times. You see some of the strangest things. You know, the mere fact someone dies doesn't mean they've gone away. It could well mean they've just changed form, so to speak. I'll go back again to Elvis. Wayne Newton, a star in his own right, swears. While performing one of Elvis' songs on stage, he glanced up and there sat Elvis in the balcony, looking down at him. And while Elvis had his quirks, he didn't begrudge someone else the opportunity to sing his songs. Newton had a long career. I saw him when he first appeared on the Lucy Show. He sang in a stable. And I saw his show in Vegas when I went back. And God, it's been 30 some odd years since I saw him. And I still remember the fascination when he came out on stage, the way the audience reacted to his presence. You know, I grew up in a home built, the original park was built in 1815. It was a antebellum home in Tennessee that began as a log cabin. And when my grandmother moved out, as the last she had sold it, moving into a smaller house, she was getting up in years. And when the last piece of furniture was taken over the back doorstep, the ceiling in the kitchen collapsed. Now, the kitchen had been the original part of the house. It was a log cabin. And in those days, whether you call them Indians or Native Americans or whatever you call them, weren't happy with the encroachment of the those that were moving into the Tennessee. And there was a place up in the ceiling you could hide from the Indians. And what we thought was just fancy woodwork on one wall was actually a ladder. And it had what was called a permanent roof on it, which means it was metal. And there was a crack in the metal that nobody knew about. The water had drained in for decades. Hundreds of gallons of water crashed into that room. And what was clearly remains of a trunk and a few other, I mean, who knows what was up there. But the history is never far away. You just have to know where to look for it. Had I known what was up there, I'd have gone up that ladder in a heartbeat. There were a number of places where I grew up that had a definite involvement with what was. Well, on that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be back on Monday. Once again, we'll be talking about the strange, the unusual. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.